Chapter 14. Lying in bed that night, sleep seemed as far from me as the moon, and I relived all the long day. I saw again Gry and her lion stand facing the priests and soldiers and the gold-cloaked man. I saw the leap of the fountain into the sunlight. I saw the Waylord stride out and down the steps beside me, saw him hold up a book before Idor and us all, and heard that strange, piercing voice. "Let them set free." The cry echoed in my mind with the other words I myself had cried out, or that had been said through me. "Broken, mend, broken." And for a moment I thought I understood. Yet I was mystified again, remembering that when I went to the front of the house with Auric and the others, the Waylord had gone back to the secret room, seeming in despair, taking refuge. He could not have gone clear back into the cave of the Oracle. There had not been time enough for that. He must have gone straight to the Shadow End, taken that book from the shelves there, and come back all the way through the rooms and corridors and courts of the great house to stride forward to face Idor, not lame, not a broken man, but healed and whole. For that brief time, for the time needed. Had he questioned the Oracle? Had he known what the book said? What book was it? I had seen it only as a small book in his hand. I had not seen its pages. I had not, could not have read from it. Surely it had been the book that spoke, not I. I was no longer certain now even of the words. Had they been, "Let them set free," or "be set free," or only "set free"? I could hear the voice in my mind, but not the words. That troubled me. I struggled to hear them, but they slipped away from me, as if through clear water. I saw the fountain, the morning sunlight over the roofs of Galvamand brightening the high blossom of the water. And then it was morning indeed, early daylight dim on the walls of my little room. And it was the holiday of Anu, who makes the way easy for the traveler, speeds the work, mends quarrels, and guides us into death. People say she goes before the dying spirit as a black cat, stopping and looking back if the shadow hesitates, sitting patiently, waiting for it to follow her. Few of our gods are given any figure or image, only Laro in stones, and Iena in the oak and willow, but Enu is often carved as a little cat, smiling with opal eyes. I had such a figure that had been my mother's. It sat in the niche beside my bed, and I kissed it every morning and night. Enu's house shrine in Galvamand is in the old inner courtyard, an incurved shell of stone on a pedestal, with the tracks of a cat carved across the floor of it, very faint, nearly worn away by the fingers that have touched them in blessing over the centuries. I got up and dressed, and took a bowl out to the Oracle fountain for water, and a handful of meal from the kitchen bin, and went to that shrine to make her offering. The Waylord met me there, and we spoke the praise of Enu together. Ista had breakfast ready for us, and then it was as the day before. The Waylord took his place in front of the gallery of the house, and people came to talk to him and to one another all day long. The community of Ansel was knitting itself together, remaking itself, here. The Waylord wanted me there with him. He said to me that the people wanted me there. And it was true, though few of them spoke to me except in greeting, a deeply respectful greeting that made me feel as if I were pretending to be somebody important. Sometimes a child was sent forward to give me flowers, dropping them on my lap or at my feet and then running away. After a while, I was so flower-bedecked I felt like a roadside shrine. I tried to understand what I was to them. They saw in me the mystery of what had happened yesterday, the fountain, the voice of the oracle. I was that mystery. The Waylord was their familiar friend and leader, a link to the old days. I was a new thing among them. He was Galva. I was the daughter of Galva, and through me the gods had spoken. But they were quite content for me not to speak. I was to smile and say nothing. Enough mystery is enough. They wanted to talk with the Waylord and with one another, to argue, to debate, to break out of 17 years' silence, full of words and passion and argument. And they did that. Some who came said they ought to be at the council house, holding their meeting there. And as the idea excited them, they were all ready to go off to the house that moment and reclaim it as the seat of our government. Sulsum Cam and Paractimo talked easily and quietly of the need to gather strength before they moved, of the need to plan and act upon plan. How could the council meet if they had not held elections? Ansel had always been wary, they said, of men who claimed power as their right. In Ansel we don't take power, we lend it, said Sulsum Cam. And charge interest on the loan, the Waylord added dryly. What the older people said carried weight with younger people, who had little or no memory of how Ansel had ruled itself, and were uncertain how to begin to restore a government they could not remember. They listened to Per because he was Auric's companion. Adira's Mera, the second hero of the city. Also I saw that when any man of the four houses spoke, people listened with respect. A respect based on nothing but habit, tradition, the known name. But useful now, because it gave some structure and measure to what might otherwise have been a competition in opinion shouting. Sulzer Galva, the most respected of all, in fact said very little, letting the others talk about their passions and their theories, listening intently, the silence at the center. Often he looked up at me, or turned to see where I was sitting. He wanted me near him. We joined our silences. As the day went on, more of the people who came to Galvamand were armed, troops of men, some with nothing but sticks and cudgels, but others with long knives, lances with new forged heads. Old swords taken from soldiers in the street battles 2 nights ago. During a long argument, I went out to breathe fresh air and look at the fountain. I went round to visit Gudit and found him at the little stable forge, hammering out a spearhead, while a young man stood waiting with a long shaft for the lance. The talk in the high room at the front of the house when I returned was less of meeting and voting and the rule of law than of assault, attack, plans to slaughter the Alds, though they didn't say so openly. They spoke only of massing strength, of gathering the forces of the city together, of stockpiling weapons, of issuing an ultimatum. I've thought often since of what I heard then, and the language they used. I wonder if men find it easier than women do to consider people not as bodies, as lives, but as numbers, figures, toys of the mind to be pushed about a battleground of the mind. This disembodiment gives pleasure, exciting them and freeing them to act for the sake of acting, for the sake of manipulating the figures, the game pieces, Love of country, or honor, or freedom, then, may be names they give that pleasure to justify it to the gods, and to the people who suffer, and kill, and die in the game. So those words, love, honor, freedom, are degraded from their true sense. Then people may come to hold them in contempt as meaningless, and poets must struggle to give them back their truth. Late in the afternoon, one of the leaders of these troops, a young man, hawk-faced and handsome, Retter Gelb of Gelbmand, urged his plan for the expulsion of the Alds from the city. Meeting some opposition among others there, he turned to the Waylord. Galva, did you not hold the book of the oracle in your hand? Did we not hear its voice, set free? How can we set our people free so long as the Ald's very presence here enslaves us? Can the meaning of the words be clearer? It might, said the Waylord. If it's not clear, then consult the oracle again, reader. Ask it if this isn't the moment to seize our liberty. You may read for yourself, the Waylord said mildly, and taking a book from his pocket, he held it out to Retter Gelb. The gesture was not threatening, but the young man started back and stood staring at the book. He was young enough that, like many people of Onsul under the Alds, he had perhaps never touched a book, never seen a book, except torn to fragments, thrown into a canal. Or it may have been fear of the uncanny, of the oracle that came over him. He said at last, hoarsely, I can't read it. And then, ashamed and trying to regain his challenging tone, he said with a quick glance at me, You Galvas are the readers. Reading was a gift we all shared once, the Waylord said, his voice no longer mild. Time may be that we all relearn it. In any case, until we understand the answer we got, there's no use asking a new question. What good is an answer we don't understand? Isn't the water of the fountain clear enough for you? I had never seen him so angry. A cold, knife-edge anger. The young man drew back again. After a pause, he bowed his head a little and said, Waylord, I beg your pardon. Retter Gelb, I beg your patience, he responded still very coldly. Let the fountain run water a while before it runs blood. He set the book down on the table and stood up. It was a small book bound in dun-colored cloth. I didn't know if it was the book that had given us the oracle or some other. Ista and Sosta were coming in with lamps. A good evening to you all and a peaceful night, the Waylord said, and taking up the book again, limped away from the crowd of people, back towards the shadowy corridors. People left the house then, bidding me a subdued good night. But many of them stayed to stand about on the maze in the courtyard, talking. There was a sense of unrest, unease all through the city, a stir in the warm, windy, darkening air. Gry came out of the house with Shetar on the leash and said to me, Let's walk over to Council Hill and see what's doing. And I gladly joined her. Auric, she said, was in the house, writing. He had mostly kept to their apartments that day. He didn't want to be part of the discussions and debates, she said, not being a citizen of Onsul. yet knowing whatever he said would be grasped at eagerly and given undue weight. "It worries him," she said. "And this feeling that something is about to happen, some violence, something fatal that can never be undone." As we walked, people constantly greeted us and saluted Gry and her lion, the first to face down Idor and the Red Hats. She smiled and returned the greetings, but in a quick, shy way that did not lead to further talk. I said, "Does it scare you, being a hero?" "Yes," she said. She laughed a little and shot me a glance. "You too," she said. I nodded. I led us off Galva Street to a byway where we would meet nobody and could talk quietly as we walked. "At least you're used to all these people." "Oh, Memer, if you knew where I came from. One street of Ansul has more houses in it than there are in all the uplands. I used to go months, years, never seeing a new face. I used to go all day, never speaking a word. I didn't live with human beings. I lived with dogs, and horses, and wild creatures, and the hills. And Auric. None of us knew how to live with other people. Except his mother, Mele. She came from the lowlands, from Dariswater. She was so lovely. I think his gift is from her. She used to tell us stories. But it's his father he's most like." "How is that?" I asked. She pondered and spoke. "Canok was a beautiful, brave man, but he feared his gift, and so he hid his heart. Sometimes I see Auric do that. Even now, it's hard to take responsibility. It's hard to have it taken from you, too," I said, thinking of the Waylord's life all the years I had known him. We came back to the street at Goldsmith's Bridge and went up to the Council Square. There were a lot of people there, drifting and swirling about. Mostly men, and many of them carrying weapons. Someone was haranguing the crowd from the terrace of the council house. Not too successfully, for people kept coming to listen and drifting away again. Over on the east side of the square was a solid line of both men and women, some afoot and some sitting down, keeping their place side by side and very much on the alert. I spoke to one of the women, a neighbor of ours, Marid. She told us they were there to keep the kids from getting into trouble. Beyond them, down the hill, torches gave enough light that we could just make out the cordon of old soldiers guarding the barracks. These citizens had made themselves a barrier between the crowd and the soldiers, preventing random insults and forays against the olds by young men looking for a fight, or by idle stone-throwers. Anybody trying to provoke the soldiers into violence would have to break through that line of fellow citizens. It continued on across the square, in front of the stables, where I had sat and talked with Sime. "You are a remarkable people," Gry said to me as we went back across the square. "I think you have peace in your bones." "I hope so," I said. We were in the center of the square, where the great tent had been. The wreckage was gone now. There was no trace of it except the blackening of the pavement stones, a slight crunch of ash and cinders under the feet. We were walking where Desac had died, burnt alive in the fire he had set. I shuddered all over, and Shetar, at the same moment, set up a long, strange wail, stretching her head up. I remembered how she had taken against a sack, glared at him. I saw him alive, straight-backed and soldierly, arrogant, passionate, talking with the Waylord. "We'll meet again, free men in a free city," he had said. His shadow was all round us. Returning, we crossed the bridge and paused at the railing from which we had seen a man thrown to his death. We looked down at the dark canal that reflected a glimmer or two of light from the houses on the bridge. Shetar growled a little, informing us that she did not want to go back down there and go swimming again. A band of boys ran past us, shouting a chant I had heard several times in the street that day. "Auld's out! Auld's out! Auld's out!" "Let's go down to the Larrow Stone," I said, and we did. Neither of us wanted to go inside on this strange night, with the city all awake and restless about us. And it was good to walk, too. After sitting still listening to people talk all day, we cut down by the slant bridge on Gelb Street to West Street and to the stone. A good many people were there, quietly waiting and doing as I came to do, to touch the stone and say the blessing of Laro, who holds the balance. We started back up West Street. I said, not knowing that I was going to say it, "Did you and Auric never have children, Gry?" "Yes, we had a daughter," she answered in her quiet voice. "She died of the fever in Messoon. She lived a half year." I could say nothing. "She'd be 17 now. How old are you, Mamère?" 17, I said, finding it very hard to say. "I thought so," Gry said. She smiled at me. I saw her smile in the faint lamplight of the high bridge. "Her name was Mele," she said. I said the name and felt the touch of the little shadow. Gry reached out her free hand to me and we walked hand in hand. "This is Enu's day," I said, as we came to the turning of Galva Street. "Tomorrow will be a day of Laro. The balance will turn." In the morning, it seemed that the balance might have turned already. We heard early that there was a great crowd gathering in the council square, not yet offering violence, but noisy and determined, demanding that the Alds leave the city this same day. The Waylord conferred briefly with Auric, and they came into the gallery together. Auric looked tense and strained. He spoke to Gry for a moment, and she went to shut Shetar into the master's room, while Gudit brought out both horses. Auric mounted Branty, Gry mounted Star, and I ran with her, following Auric through the crowds in Galva Street. They willingly parted for us, calling out Auric's name. He rode to the line of citizens, still holding firm in the square in front of the line of soldiers. There he asked both the citizens and the soldiers if he might speak with the Gand Yorath. They let him through at once. He dismounted and ran down the steps towards the old barracks. I held Branty's bridle now, there in the crowd like a real groom. He didn't need much holding. He stood solidly, alert, but not troubled by the hubbub all round. And I tried to imitate him. Star shook her head often, whuffing and shuffling when people pressed up too close, and I tried not to imitate her. I was glad, though, that the horses kept a little space around us, for the presence of so many people was overwhelming. I could not think clearly, and emotions ran through me. Elation, dread, excitement. They ran through us all, like the wind through leaves on a tree before a storm. I held Branty's bridle and watched Gry's face, which was still and calm. There was a deep roaring in the crowd nearer the steps of the council house. Everybody turned that way, but I could see nothing over the heads and shoulders. Gry touched my arm and indicated that I should mount Branty. "I can't," I said, but I couldn't hear myself, and she was making a hand stirrup for me, and a man near us said, "Up you go, girl." And I was abruptly sitting in the saddle on Branty's back, bewildered. Gry swung up onto Star right beside me. "Look," she said. And I looked. People stood on the speaker's terrace. A woman in a dun and white striped gown, and Auric in his black coat and kilt. They looked very small and bright to me, like images. The crowd was shouting and chanting. Some people were calling out, "Tyrio! Tyrio!" A man near us shouted ragefully, "Old's whore! Gan's whore!" And immediately people turned on him, shouting at him with equal rage, while others tried to hush and separate them. I could not reach the stirrups with my feet and felt most insecure perched way up there on the saddle. But Branty stood like a rock, and I was at least safe from the pushing and trampling of the crowd. Gradually, the noise died away. Auric had raised his right hand. "Let the Maker speak!" people cried. And silence spread out slowly across the crowd, as the water of the fountain had spread out across the wide basin. When he spoke at last, his voice rang out, distant but clear and resonant. "This is Laro's day," he said, and said nothing further for a long time, for the whole crowd took up the deep, slow chant of "Laro, Laro, Laro," and my breath caught, and tears filled my eyes, and I was chanting with them, "Laro, Laro, Laro." At last he raised his hand again, and the chant died away down the streets leading to the square. "I, who am not of Ansul and not of Asudar, will you let me speak again to you?" "Yes," the crowd roared, "and speak, let the Maker speak." "Tyrio Actimo, daughter of Ansul and wife of the Gand of the Alds, stands here with me. She and her husband ask me to say this to you. The soldiers of Asudar will not attack you. They will not interfere with you. They will not leave their barracks. Such are the Gand Yorath's orders, and his soldiers will obey. But he cannot order the soldiers to leave Ansul without the consent of his king in Medron. So he waits to hear from Medron. And he and Tyrio Actimo and I beg you to be patient, and to take your city back, and claim your freedom in peace, not in blood. I, who saw the ruler betrayed and imprisoned, set free. I, who with you saw water leap from the fountain that was dry 200 years, and heard with you the voice that cried aloud from silence. I, your guest, while we wait together for Lero to show us how the balance falls, and whether we are to destroy or to rebuild, to fall to war or walk in peace. While we wait, may I offer in return for your hospitality and the grace of the gods of Anzul a story of war and peace, of slavery and freedom? Will you hear the Chamhan? Will you hear the tale of Hamneda when he was made a slave in Ambion? Yes, the crowd said. And now the sound was like a great soft wind in grass. We could all feel the tension in us lessening, and we were grateful for it. Grateful to the voice that freed us from dread and passion and unreason, if only for a little while, for the time it takes to tell a story. Anywhere else in all the Western Shore, people would have known that story, even here, where the books had been destroyed. Many in the crowd knew it, or at least knew the hero's name. But many had never read the story nor heard it told. And to hear it told aloud, among a great throng openly asserting our inheritance as our right and our heroes as our own, that was a great thing to us, a great gift Auric gave us. He told it as if he himself had never known it before, and discovered it as he spoke it, as if the betrayal of Hamneda by Aelak appalled him, as if he were chained and beaten with Hamneda, and wept with him at the torture and death of old Afer, and feared for the slaves who risked their lives to help him escape. He was no longer telling the Chamhan I had read, but his own tale in his own words. When he came to the confrontation in the palace of Ambion, when Hamneda released the tyrant Ura from his chains, bidding him be gone from Ambion, and said to the rebels of the city, "Freedom is a lion let loose, the sun rising. You cannot stop it here or there. Give liberty to have liberty. Set free to be free." Since then, I have heard people maintain that that is what the voice of the oracle said on the steps of Galvamand. Set free to be free. Maybe it was so. In any case, when they heard those words, the crowd in the council square made the sound a great crowd makes when it hears said what it wants to hear. When Auric finished the tale, they were not silent, but roared praise, and their mood was jubilant, as if they themselves had been freed from constraint or dread. They flooded up around Auric on the terrace of the council house, and Gry and I had no chance at all of getting to him. We could, however, from our horseback height, see him and Tyrio, and we saw the crowd begin to swirl around them and carry them slowly towards Galva Street. Gry hopped off Star and shortened my stirrups, then swung up again into her saddle. "Hold with your knees, and never mind the reins," she called. And we set off, surrounded by our own swirl of praise and jokes and shouting, on my first horseback ride, out of the square, across the three bridges of Galva Street, to Galvamand. The people parted and made way for us, so that we soon caught up to Auric and Tyrio. Dismounting at our stable gate, I ran back to the house in time to see Tyrio's meeting with the Waylord in the gallery. He stood up, seeing her, and she ran forward with her hands held out, saying his name, Salter. They embraced and held each other, both in tears. They had been friends when they were young, maybe lovers. I don't know. They had known each other in youth and wealth and happiness, and then been separated for years of shame and pain. He was crippled. She had been beaten, her hair torn out. I remembered how he had said to me long ago, tenderly, There's a good deal to weep about, Mimir. I cried then, too. For them. For the grief of the world. Auret came beside me as I stood there inside the doorway trying to hide my tears. His face still had the bewildered brightness of one who has been acclaimed, taken out of himself by the power of the crowd. But he put his arm round my shoulders and said softly, Hello, horse thief. It seemed as if Auric and Laro had tipped the balance. That day and the days following, there was still tremendous unrest in the city, but it was less rageful, less threatening. There was a lot of angry talk, but fewer weapons were brandished. The council house was opened for debate on the planning of an election. People kept coming to Galvaman to talk in the gallery and to dance the maze. I saw it at last. I saw women dance the maze. After a day or two, Ista went out among them, scowling, with a dishcloth in her hand, and said, You've got it all wrong. You turn here when you sing Echo. And then you turn there. And she showed them how to dance the blessing properly. After that, she went back to the kitchen. She was working very hard, and so were Bomi and I and even Sosta. People kept bringing gifts to the house, gifts of food, knowing how strained our hospitality must be with the endless flow of guests. Ista had brought herself to accept them. Not as gifts exactly, or honor, or tribute, but as what was due the Waylord and his house, as debts owing and repaid. So her mind worked, like many minds in Onsul. If we have peace in our bones, we have commerce in them too. Ialba went back with Tyrio to help her care for Yorath, whose burns were severe and slow to heal. The next day, Tyrio sent 3 women from the barracks to help us keep the house. They were city women who had been taken and kept as slaves for the use of the soldiers like Tyrio. As she won the Gan's favor, she had been able to bring them out of utter subjugation to a more decent servitude. One of them, who had been taken and used by the soldiers as a girl of 10 or 11, was crippled. And a little mad. But if we set her at any task of cleaning where she could work alone, she worked hard and contentedly. The others had both been of respectable households, knew how to keep a house, and were of great assistance to us. Ista was inclined at first to treat them coldly, and tried to keep them from talking to Sosta and me. Look at what they'd been after all. No doubt it wasn't their fault, but they were no fit company for young girls of a good house, and so on. They and I paid no attention to that. One of them had a man friend she'd known as a slave. He moved right in and took a hand with the heavy work. Gudit got on pretty well with him, because he had been a cartwright, and could plan how to build a carriage out of the broken-down bits of carts and wagons Gudit had been hoarding for years. So in a few days, there was a great increase of people, of life in the house, and I liked it. There were more voices and not so many shadows. There was a little more order, a little less dust. Many hands touched the God niches now in passing worship, not just mine. But these days I saw very little of the way, Lord. Only in public, among others. And I had not been to the secret room since the night the oracle spoke through me. My life had been suddenly and wholly changed. I lived in the streets, not in books, and talked to many people all day long instead of to one man alone in the evening. And my heart was full of auric and gry, so that sometimes I didn't even think of him. If I felt shame for that, I could excuse myself. I'd been important to him when I was the only person close to him. But now he no longer needed me. He was truly the waylord again. He had the whole city to keep him company. He had no time for me. And I had no time to go to the secret room, nights as I had done for so many years. I was busy all day, tired at night. I kissed my little Ennu and fell asleep. The books in that room had kept me alive while my city was dead. But now it was coming back to life, and I had no need of them. No time, no need. If I was afraid to go there, afraid of the room, of the books, I didn't let myself know it.